By way of review, we are really going to pick up the pace in this story. Please turn to Genesis chapter 41. Genesis chapter 41. Last week we looked at Pharaoh's two very, very intense, disturbing dreams. He was dead convinced that the dreams meant something terrible was going to happen. But the problem was, he did not know what it meant. He could not interpret the dreams himself. So then he got all his paid magicians and the wise men of Egypt to come, and he would tell it to them, and they had no idea. It was blank faces. They're not able to interpret the dream for him. So then finally, after two cozy years, the cupbearer's like, oh yeah, I remember Joseph. And finally he brings up Joseph in conversation to the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh says, bring him in. Brings in Joseph. Joseph, first thing, corrects the Pharaoh, gives the glory to God. No, I cannot do this. God can work through me as a conduit, and I can tell you what God is helping me tell you, say, and interpret this dream. So he interprets the dream. He says it in such a way that Pharaoh is completely satisfied. I believe that God made Pharaoh feel relieved and that the interpretation was perfect. And all the other servants in the room that were Pharaoh's men all were like, that's it. That is the correct interpretation. And then we ended last week with Joseph being promoted to second in command. He gets all the power. Things are going really well to that point. But the thing I stressed so much last week was this is not the climax of the story. It's not like everything else now after this is superfluous and doesn't matter. No, we're not even halfway through the Joseph story. But this is not the all-encompassing top moment of Joseph's life. This is significant, and it's going to have implications and good stuff, but this is not the climax of the story. So we're in Genesis 41. We're going to finish this chapter pretty quickly and then jump right into chapter 42. So one primary question right before I read verse 45. This should be in our mind. The question is, has Joseph compromised? He's been given all this power. Remember, he was given the ring, the signet ring. He can do all this official stuff. He's now in chariots where people are just bowing down to him. He's given all this authority, all this power. Is he still a Hebrew follower of God or not? Look at verse 45. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah, and he gave him to wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. And that's connections to Ra. I don't know if you know anything about Egyptian hieroglyphs, but it's the dude with the falcon head and the sun above him. That's Ra. That's like one of the main, quote-unquote, gods from Egypt. And it's the daughter of this priest. And Joseph went out all over the land of Egypt. So the question is, how come he's marrying an Egyptian woman? How come? Because when we connect it to the New Testament, we're like, okay, don't be unequally yoked with unbelievers. Aren't you supposed to marry Christians? How come he's marrying an Egyptian woman? And I would agree with that you're not supposed to be yoked with unbelievers. And wait, even in the generations of Joseph that we've seen throughout the story, wasn't Abraham so particular about telling his servant, okay, you're going to find a wife for my son Isaac, and you must find a wife from the children of Israel, not from the pagan, idolatrous lands. And that's true. So much so that even Isaac, in good parenting, followed the same thing in telling and getting a wife for Jacob. So obviously that's highlighted. So is this something that's gone super off with Joseph, that he has now a wife that is this Egyptian? And I have like two or three things to say about that. First, number one, this appears forced, all right? If you look in the text, it says that the Pharaoh gave, and he gave to him the wife, all right? Just like he gave Joseph all the other things, of the ring, the power, the authority, all that stuff that Joseph didn't ask for. So it appears forced. Second, I think it's a really great principle that we have to be really careful about assuming things when we're not given a lot of information. Right? We're not given Joseph's take on this at all. It doesn't say, well, Joseph thought this, or his motives, or whatever. We're not told that. But it's like, okay, well, it's the pagan priest's daughter. Okay, you made your point. one more thing to remember. Just because it is the pagan priest's daughter doesn't necessarily mean that she was a pagan, that she believed in these gods. Not necessarily. I know it's a weak argument, but we try not to make the assumption ourselves in Christianity. We don't look at necessarily people in our church and leadership positions and say, okay, automatically their kids are saved and good and good standing and all and perfect. We don't necessarily make that judgment. So why would we make it in this text? We're just not given a lot of information. So what we've seen from Joseph so far, I think we can give him the benefit of the doubt. Look at verse 50. And now unto Joseph were born two sons before the years of the famine came, which Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, the priest of On, bare unto him. And this is something I think is tremendously important at answering the question of, okay, is he still aligned with God? How does he name his kids? And Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh. It's a Hebrew name, not an Egyptian name. All these changes in his life, the Pharaoh is trying to make him Egyptian, and he chooses Hebrew names for his kids. What does Manasseh mean? He actually kind of gives the definition. For God, said he, hath made me forget all my toil in all my father's house. Names are obviously, I've stressed this before, tremendously important back then. Much more than they are now. The name Manasseh means causing to forget. So it's really echoing his past and his struggles with his family. Obviously his brothers throwing in and selling him and just the bad stuff there. 52, and the name of the second he called Ephraim. Again, another Hebrew name. For God hath caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. Even there we see that Joseph doesn't exactly paint a nice picture of Egypt. The land of my affliction. All right, we'll continue verse 53. And the 7 years of plenteousness that was in the land of Egypt were ended. Okay, 7 years go by. Remember the dream, interpretation of dream, that's going to be super, super prosperous. And it is. But then those 7 years end. And the 7 years of dearth began to come, according to what Joseph had said. And the dearth was in all lands. Okay, not just Egypt. Other nations are being impacted by this drought. But in all the land of Egypt, there was bread. And when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried unto Pharaoh for bread. And Pharaoh said unto all the Egyptians, go unto Joseph. What he saith to you, do. That's delegation right there. And the famine was over all the face of the earth, and Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold unto the Egyptians, and the famine waxed sore in the land of Egypt, and all countries, again, just not just the Egyptian land, came into Egypt to Joseph to buy corn because the famine was so sore in all the lands. Question, and we'll just make this not rhetorical, so you can answer this. Think it through first before you answer. Why didn't Joseph go back home? Why didn't Joseph go back home? 7 years of plenty. We're going to see later on that the Pharaoh is actually really sympathetic to Joseph. And he gives him authority. I mean, basically, if Joseph wants something, the Pharaoh's like, sure, whatever. You're smart. You can do it. And yeah, perhaps he's still angry with his brother. Okay. Why else? Yes.
He knows that within 7 years, he has the means and wherewithal to make abundance with the utilities and the tools and the agriculture and the Nile that Egypt has, that he knows that his family will not be prepared in 7 years. So if he goes back home, they can't prepare for the drought that's coming.
Okay. But at least Joseph could have sent a representative of himself to at least know how they're doing. And he doesn't do anything. And 7 years go by, and then 2 years during the famine years go by. So it's 9 years in total. And he still has not contacted his family. Any other ideas? Yeah.
Like in all his other jobs, he was really good in them and like did everything to the full and did what wasn't expected of him, so maybe he was just trying to do his job and give God the glory for it and be a good Christian example.
Okay, he wants to be an example, maybe. The fact that things are going well in Egypt and he's helping a nation survive. God is putting him in this place of second in command, and he's definitely helping the Egyptians. Okay. A lot of these answers, I think, are good. I think the main reason, again, ties with his family and these troubles that he's going through. When you look at families that have terrible, and whether it's teens or little kids, and they have terrible family situations, I don't know, whatever, abuse, whether it's neglect, whether it's drugs and addictions and selfishness and all that stuff, and you see these terrible families, and you look at those that go through that, and then later on in life, they don't even want to talk about it. All they want to do is forget. Why bring up old wounds? So often that's what they say. And I'm not saying it's necessarily the best thing to do, but that's what people think. And that's what I think really Joseph's thinking. He hasn't distanced himself from God, because we see that when it comes to interpreting the dream, very first thought, right out of prison, he wants to glorify God. And then he names his sons Hebrew names, still keeping his identity as a Hebrew. So he hasn't distanced himself from God, but he seemingly has distanced himself from his family. But it's understandable. So 9 years go by. Now we're in Genesis 42. So probably don't have to switch a page. That's okay. Now the camera's going to really pan out of the whole Joseph situation in Egypt. And now we're going to focus back on Jacob's family, which we haven't seen since chapter 38 with Judah and all his sin, and that whole chapter of him making really, really poor decisions. So we haven't seen them. We don't know really what's going on with them. But now we will. And one more thing. Of the chapters we've covered so far, it's been chapters 37 through 41, 15 years have passed in those chapters. This next section, where he's talking with his brothers, that is 2 to 3 months. And they're about the identical in length, in verses. 15 years, a lot happens. And now we have like 2 to 3 months in this next section. All right, 42, verse 1. Now when Jacob saw that there was corn in Egypt, Jacob said unto his sons, "Why do you look one upon another?" And he said, "Behold, I have heard that there was corn in Egypt. Get you down thither, and buy for us from thence, that we may live and not die." So things aren't that great at home. And it's like Jacob's talking to his older kids that are in 30s, 40s, and probably maybe even 50s, and he's talking to them like they're little kids. Like, "Hey, guys, why are you just staring at each other? You should be trying to take care of the family with this famine. We're like down to nothing, and you're just staring at each other." So things aren't that great. You know, they were so clever in getting rid of Joseph out of their life. So smart, and even making money out of it. But now when it comes to something important and noble, like saving the family line, they're just staring at each other. And Jacob's getting frustrated. So he says, "Go down to Egypt. I've heard that things are going well down there. Do something." Verse 3, "And Joseph's 10 brethren went down to buy corn in Egypt, but Benjamin, the youngest, Joseph's brother, Jacob sent not with his brethren. For he said, lest peradventure mischief befall him." Ouch. It's like we're looking at Jacob repeating the same mistake of favoritism. And all his affection that went for Joseph now seemingly has gone to Benjamin. And you're like, ugh. So he looks at the 10 oldest and says, "You weren't able to," he's not saying this, but it's like implication, "You weren't able to protect Joseph from all these wild animals. I'm not entrusting you with Benjamin. You're all expendable. But I'm going to keep Benjamin here, even though it's famine, even though sending Benjamin down there would be sending Benjamin to food. He keeps Benjamin." Review question that I went over ages and ages ago for $1. You can buy 2 sodas with this. If you answer this question and give one of the answers I gave to this question, is Benjamin now new to this story, having been born and grew up while Joseph was gone, and why? Or why not? Nick.
Because Joseph was gone and Benjamin was born, but his mother died.
Incorrect.
Can you restate the question?
Yeah. Yes.
Is Benjamin now new to this story, having been born and grown up while Joseph was gone? Why or why not?
Why is he new?
Well, Joseph's mother died, she died on their journey to, like, where Jacob is now.
Canaan, correct.
So Benjamin would have to be, like, older than just like a little child in this.
So you disagree that Benjamin was born after Joseph was sold?
Yes.
That's correct. You've earned 100 cents. Congratulations. That was one of the reasons I gave. Yep. Correct. That's it. See me after 4 years. Glorious. Washington. So Benjamin should be in his late 20s, maybe early 30s here. All right, just keep that in mind. It's important for the story because in the movies they portray him usually typically as this young kid, and he's not a young kid. All right, I also made the point that when he comes back to Egypt, which is going to be 2 to 3 months from now where we're in the story, he already has 10 kids, so he's not that young. All right, verse 5. And the sons of Israel came to buy corn among those that came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. And Joseph was the governor over the land, and he it was that sold to all the people of the land. Okay, the author is stressing here, saying, hey, remember, Joseph has all this authority, all this power. Remember that. And Joseph's brethren came, bowed down themselves before him, like partial fulfillment of the dream, with their faces to the earth, and Joseph saw his brethren. Can you imagine how intense this scene is? It was just like any other normal day of selling grains, all these different nations, and to his own people, if you want to call them his own, selling this grain to the Egyptians, dealing with family after family, making sure the exchange rate was fair, making sure that there was security to see if any nations that were coming perhaps to spy on them, considering that Egypt now is the number one source of food. Maybe some nations would be like, no, I'd rather not pay. I'd rather just steal and take and plunder those grain houses instead of buying it and getting a tiny amount. So, regular day, the next family comes. They're really gracious. Yes, you're welcome. Thank you for paying, blah, blah, blah. Next family comes, and it's his brothers he hasn't seen in over 20 years. Imagine the images that are going in his head at this moment. And all he has to do is snap his fingers, and you could have them all killed. Have instant revenge. The feelings he must be going through at this point, and you know they're probably getting out their coins to pay for the grain, saying, okay, we can pay. You know, he sees the coins, and all he can think of is them bartering for his life from the pit with the Ishmaelites, saying 20 pieces of silver. All the emotions going through his mind at this point. In debts. And he knew them, but made himself strange unto them. Okay, made himself strange unto them. He's not yodeling or doing Fortnite dances at this point. He's disguising himself. Alright? He's making it so they cannot see any Hebrewness about him at all, that they can realize that, wait, he's not Egyptian. He kind of looks familiar. He's disguising himself. He's speaking through an interpreter. We know that through later on in the story. So they don't see him speaking in Hebrew. He's talking Egyptian to other guys, then they translate. And he spake roughly unto them, and he said unto them, whence come ye? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. And Joseph knew his brethren, again, emphasis, but they knew him not. Which is perfectly understandable. They haven't seen him since he was 17. Now he's like 39. And what facial hair he would have had normally at a 17-year-old, patchy like mine. In Egyptian culture, he would be cleanly shaven. It's like, well, I remember statues and pharaohs and having goatees and stuff. It was all fake. They hated facial hair. So he would have been completely shaved. He would have been in more royal robes. They don't recognize him. And he's speaking through an interpreter. Verse 9, and Joseph remembered the dreams which he dreamed of them. It's like the Bug's Life moment where Flick realizes that the warrior bugs that are going to save them from Hopper aren't warrior bugs, and they're the circus bugs. And it does that camera zoom in right into his face and his eyeballs. His pupils just go really tiny. And it's just like, he remembers the dreams, all right? That's what I picture. It's silly. But
Have you ever seen that movie?
Yeah. I'm dating myself as a 90s kid. Oh, good. More than I thought.
Oh,
yes.
That was
we
so
are
many
saved.
More than I thought.
We are saved. It's vivid. All right, moving on, verse 9. And he said unto them, ye are spies. To see the nakedness of the land are ye come. So Joseph, he speaks roughly to them. He basically, through these next few verses, it's like he interrogates them. And another question is, you know, is he doing this out of some fleshly, just trying to get even? type of moment, or is that a disguise too? What would you want to know if you were in Joseph's situation? And over 20 years has passed. What would you want to know if you were Joseph in this situation? You just met your brothers. You haven't seen them in ages. They've aged a little bit, but you completely, 100% know it's them. What do you want to know? What do you not know?
How's Dad doing?
You don't know how Jacob's doing. You don't even know if they've killed him. You don't even know if Benjamin's alive. The next in line, youngest, who, by the way, came from Rachel. All the others came from Leah. So he has a big target on his back. Doesn't know if Benjamin's alive. So you want to know that first. And how are you going to find that out? If you were just to say, if you were just to stop at that point, speak in Hebrew and say, ha, dreams are true. How's the family doing? They're going to tell him, because he's second in command of Egypt, they're going to tell him exactly what he wants to hear. No promise, no guarantee of them being genuine or truthful in anything that they say. So he doesn't give away who he is. He doesn't snap his fingers and kill them all either. Okay. What would you do? So he does these tests, these numerous tests to find out their true character, if they've changed at all in over 20 years. And it's really fascinating to think about. But test number one, is Benjamin alive? Verse 10, and they said unto him, nay, my lord, okay, they're not spies, but to buy food are thy servants come. We are all one man's sons, so they think, okay, if we just explain our story, they're going to be nicer to us. We are all one man's sons. We are true men. Fail. They're saying they're honest. It's like, okay, true, you're not spies, but you're everything else. It's bad. Thy servants are no spies. And he said unto them, nay, no, but to see the nakedness of the land ye are come. And they give more of the background. 13, and they said, thy servants are 12 brethren, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. Behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is not. Kind of humorous, considering the one that is not is standing right before them. But, he's right there. And Joseph said unto them, that is it that I spoke to you, unto you, saying, ye are spies. You know, this is it. Hereby ye shall be proved. By the life of Pharaoh ye shall not go forth hence, except your younger brother come hither. So, test number one, is Benjamin alive and well? 16, send one, this is actually really, really important. I've missed this. This is like new to me. I miss this in all the other times I learned the story. Send one of you, and let him fetch your brother, and ye shall be kept in prison, and that by your words so you may be proved, whether they be true in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely, you're spies. And he put them all together into the ward, into a prison, for 3 days. He says, send one of you, and let him fetch your brother. He actually gives them the initiative. What's the one question they're going to be thinking of for 72 hours? Which one? Which one is going to go get Benjamin? That's the one thing that he gave them authority, basically. 72 hours go by. 18. And Joseph said unto them the third day, this do and live, for I fear God. If ye be true men, let one of your brethren be bound in the house of your prison. Go ye, carry corn for the famine of your houses, but bring your youngest brother unto me. So shall your words be verified, and ye shall not die. And he did so. Do you see them at all picking a person to go? No. No one shows any leadership. To give them the option would let Joseph know who's in charge. No one takes charge. Great opportunity for Reuben, the eldest, to step up and say, I'll go do it. No one wants to go back to see Jacob to say, by the way, everyone's in prison and we need Benjamin. Like, that's not going to fly. So they don't do anything. They're like, it's like at the start of the chapter where they're just sitting around staring at each other. They don't make it a decision. So then Joseph changes the rules and says, okay, you can all go except one. So instead of one leaving, you can all leave except one. So that changes things, you know. Now what information is he trying to get?
Who's like the generous one? Will stay in prison.
Right, and that person would have to trust the rest of the brothers. Who's the guy that's going to be most accommodating to that question? And it says they did so. And then later on, it appears that they chose a person. Because of that's in there. And it literally means that I like checked the words to make sure everything was clear. And it literally appears that they actually were like, okay. And they picked a person to stay. Test number three. They passed. So the first test is Benjamin alive? Which we haven't found out yet. Number two, can you pick one person to go? Nope. Can they pick one person to stay? Yes, they can. They can trust one brother to stay. 21. And they said to one another, we are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore is this distress come upon us. And Reuben, he now sealed us. Now he's speaking. Now he's doing something. And Reuben answered them, saying, spake not I not unto you, saying, do not sin against the child, and you would not hear. Therefore, behold, also his blood is required. So Reuben's like trying to defend himself. It's like, guys, this wasn't part of my plan. I said, don't do him any harm. And then you guys throw me this pit and you sell him to slavery. Now, and Joseph mentioned God in verse 18. It's like, now God's against us. All of this is coming back, and now we have to pay. But this is actually good news. Why is this good news? Yes?
They feel guilty.
Okay, yeah, there's some sense of brokenness that they've done something wrong. Have they viewed Joseph up to this point as part of the family?
Yeah.
Up to this point? No. Because he's Rachel's son. He's not part of our group. Because the favoritism, that kind of made it even worse. So he hasn't been part of the family. But now that they're saying, when he besought us, we would not hear, and this distress is come upon us, they're actually understanding what he went through. Initially, if you remember in the story, they threw him in the pit and they had lunch. They ate while he screamed. And now they're like, oh, now they feel it. So it's like, okay, now we're getting somewhere. There's a difference here that I think is really, really important between reunion and a reconciliation. You can have reunion and meet up with people and not have reconciliation. That's why in big, big family gatherings, there's so-and-so that had an argument with so-and-so and they're not talking to each other and they avoid each other. One gets the food, the one goes this way. You can have reunion without reconciliation. Reconciliation is rebuilding of trust in each other. And we're going to see if that happens in this story. And this is actually the first time, really fascinating, that Joseph heard Reuben's side of the story. Because remember, they had all those discussions when Joseph was way off into the distance. So Joseph never knew what the oldest son, the one that was supposed to take the most responsibility, the oldest son, what he thought of the whole situation. So you can kind of imagine where this is going, but how do you think Joseph's response would be? Maybe emotional? Because they're actually kind of admitting their guilt. And they knew not that Joseph understood them, for he spake unto them by an interpreter, and he turned himself about from them and wept. Can't handle even being with them without giving it away. So he leaves. And returned to them again and communed with them, and they took from them Simeon. He's the chosen one to stay in prison. And bound him before their eyes. So again, so much emotion through this whole process. Whether it's reconciliation or reunion, there's cost. Okay. There's going to be tears. These are the old wounds that are coming open again. The past is now in the forefront. He can't forget anymore. Because God has made these two groups of people, they made them interact with each other. So we will see what happens with the other tests next week. But that's where we're kind of at. But in terms of forgiveness and reconciliation, we are to seek reconciliation whenever possible as Christians. Thank you for listening.